Hi, and welcome to this, which is effectively the Christmas special edition episode of the VFX show for Avatar. I feel like this is the episode we've been building to the entire history of the VFX show. And the reason I say that is that two of our regular guests here on the VFX show are actually members of the Avatar production team. And we have also a fourth host with us this week, but I'll get to Ian in 1 second. So starting with you, David, welcome, David Strapinas.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good. Now, David, we got you on a phone line because you're actually in a particularly tropical, sunny beach somewhere relaxing after having worked on Avatar, I believe.
Yes, I'm in the tropical resort of London, England, where it's, I believe, about -2 right now, and I'm quite cold. So I just got home from work a few minutes ago, and it's very cold out. compared to Southern California.
So, David, you worked on the film for about 3 years, and we're going to come back to your role in a second. But we're also joined by Mark Christensen. Mark, how are you?
Doing fine, Mike.
Now, you're coming to us from, I guess, a mild but very pleasant San Francisco.
It is mild and pleasant today.
And now, Mark, you worked on the film perhaps not as long as David, but you're working... through which facility in San Fran?
Through Spy Post in San Francisco.
Okay, and so we'll come back to that in 1 second. And then the last of our hosts to balance out these two actual insiders is I'm joined for the first time actually on the show by Ian. Ian, how are you?
Good, Mike. How are you going?
Now, Ian, you write for us at FX Guide and also have your own blog. Ian, I'm very keen to have you on the show because we need to balance out these two insiders' view because they're a bit biased on this little film that they've been working on. So let's swing our attention around now to just what everyone actually did. Now, we've done our introductions. And I guess, David, let's start back with you. I said that you're on the film for about 3 years, but actually you're in a very particular role on the film.
Right. So I joined the team in August of 2006. We were very small at the time. I believe there was about five of us. And we were essentially, I refrain from calling us pre-viz, but we were starting to build what would become the virtual production department. And it was me, Nolan Murtha, who is... wound up getting, I believe, the credit of visual effects supervisor, Richie Banham, who is the production side animation supervisor, Brad Alexander, who owns a previz company called Halon, myself and Tom Bland were, who are just basically generalists. And within about a week of me being there, they decided to put me on stage, what we called a stage operator. It's a role that, you know, has never really existed before. You know, we were doing all of our mocap was provided by Giant Studios, and they have this amazing software that does a real-time mocap solve. It's creatively called Real-Time. And we would build a scene in Motion Builder that was pretty elaborate, and then we would take their mocap data, which was being broadcast live, out to us, and that way... we would not only have a live camera, which has been discussed before, but, you know, as an actor was out there doing something, we would have a corresponding puppet, whether that puppet was human, that was going to be filled in later by an actual photographic human, or digidouble. The amp suits, the vehicles, or, of course, the avatars and Navi. And we would run that all real-time with whatever the demands of the production, meaning Jim, were. So we might have to build a rig, do some effects, do lighting, or whatever, all in real time.
So let me just get the timeline. Let me get the timeline for this, because I understand what happened is that Jim Cameron approached Fox and got an initial, I think it was like $10 million or whatever, seed money to start what was effectively this production studio, with the idea that you'd develop the technology for Avatar and Battle Angel. And that was... basically this kind of initial R&D stage before you even started filming. Were you in on that test?
No, that was back in 2005 when I was still at Sony. And actually, their prototype went out to a bunch of different facilities to bid on. And I remember it coming into Sony right before I left. But that prototype was pretty incredible. ILM wound up doing a very quick proof of concept, taking it through to finished material that was, I thought, very, very impressive, but compared to the final product was rudimentary, shall we say. That's not to discount it in any way, shape, or form. It was, for its time, best of class animation. It's just that what the final product, as delivered by Weta, turned out to be was unbelievable.
So let's just give some credit to the people that are involved. ILM did that initial test, which I think ended up being about 40 seconds. But it was Weta that basically scored principal facility. And obviously Weta has, as does ILM, tremendous pedigree in producing digital synthetic environments and digital actors. But it was Weta that we really think of as being the facility that was delivering the finals on the digital characters, if I'm correct. Is that right, David?
For the most part, other than ILM did deliver some of the end battle sequence that did have some characters, but everything from a cowboy up, a cowboy shot, meaning, from the knees to the head, anything close to that, and definitely all of those fantastic close-ups were all delivered by Weta.
Right, and then we've actually, over at FX Guide, we're obviously separately doing a story or stories on this, and we spoke to John Knoll at ILM, so they were responsible for a lot of the helicopter gunship battle sequence stuff. And there were good reasons for that. They were brought in a little later than Weta. So they did a large amount of work, but it was more of the battle sequences, the terrain, a lot of the stuff with the floating mountains and stuff. And then there were a number of other companies like Framestore in London who did the arrival at Hell's Gate and stuff. And then, Mark, where did your company fit into the scheme of things?
So SpyPost was reconstituted by one of the founders of the orphanage, Jonathan Rothbart, and one of the principal designers there, actually the principal designer from the orphanage, Dal Varage, who was the guy who, with a team at the orphanage last year, did all the heads-up UIs for Iron Man. And based on the success of that work, the orphanage was, I believe, bidding similar work on Avatar around the beginning of the year. And the orphanage failed to survive the result of that bid. I think the bid probably would have gone to them in some shape or form. But as we all know, they closed back in February. So that team reformed just to bid this and not to offer a full effects facility approach to it, but really to do the designs themselves. So, in fact, SpyPost functioned as a design studio, and I believe final one shot between all of us, and everything else, basically, we were handing off designs, motion designs, and giving kind of a template that I think was then seen through by predominantly by Pixel Liberation Front.
I think PLF they ended hybrid.
Up. Yeah, hybrid was the other one.
So literally, you were functioning in two capacities. Obviously, as you say, you final the shot, but you actually functioning as a design studio. And Rav's stuff is just absolutely brilliant. I've got to say, I have so much admiration for that Iron Man work and stuff. It's just awesome. So let me just leave you two now for a second to do what we normally do on the VFX show, which is just discuss whether or not we liked the film. And I'm going to take it as a given that you two liked it. I'm going to talk now, if I can, with Ian just briefly, because Ian, this film has been critically as well as it seems like a box office hit straight out of the gate. So just today, Roger Ebert published his top 10 list of films for the year. Now, he doesn't like to say which is the best film, but he has a category that is basically the best of the best, the special jury award which he gave to Avatar. So from what I consider to be one of the America's leading film critics right through to me personally, I really enjoyed this film. Ian, what about you?
I absolutely loved it. And I think as a fan of visual effects films, I've been waiting a long time for it. And so I guess the expectations were pretty high. But after coming out of it twice now, I think they really nailed it.
Now, where did you see it? What environment you're seeing? Because obviously there's a mono and a stereo version, and there's an IMAX stereo version. What did you see?
I've seen it in IMAX and just in, you know, normal theater in 3D.
But both times it was 3D?
Yeah, both times it was 3D. Right.
So that's what I did. I saw it in IMAX digital stereo, and I did that obviously very deliberately. And I've got to say, for me, as somebody who is very interested in 3D but not necessarily an evangelist for the cause, I found it to be totally immersive and incredibly interesting in the fact that pretty much I got over the 3D very early on and then spent all my time wondering about how the hell they pulled off the visual effects shots. So definitely, without a doubt, in terms of live action, the best 3D I've ever seen. Would you agree, Ian?
I would. And I'd also say that I don't think James Cameron used the 3D too much in terms of the stereoscopic, because as you say, you sort of got over that quickly, and it was just part of the, you know, the process of watching.
Now you say that, but I actually took the glasses off at a couple of points because obviously I'm a nerd, and there was actually quite a lot of stereoscopic effect going on. I think what happened is it was just so well done, and I'll get you guys to buy in this, like David and Mark, but it seemed to be so well done that I sort of discounted its effect as actually being happening, whereas in fact it was actually happening quite strongly nearly all the time.
Well, here's the thing. And just to comment, like, the one thing that is really unfortunate, I guess, for myself, is a lot of people are coming out of the movie with these, you know, incredibly strong emotional reactions to the film. You know, that it's just a major experience. And that's one thing I didn't get out of the film, because all I saw was all the stuff that got cut out and all the hard, you know, it was very satisfying and emotional level to see all those years of hard work up there on the screen, but there was a whole lot of this movie that was cut out, a whole lot, and you know, that was a little bit almost painful for me to see how much was cut out, because you know, I know there have been some qualms and complaints about story or lack of character development, and all I'll say is it was 2 hours and 40 minutes, but there's a whole lot in there, and if you saw the 4-hour cut, there'd be no complaints about any of that, but there's a limit to what people will sit through. But in terms of the stereo, I would just ask you, how much do you notice, you know, focus and depth of field in a regular 2D film? You don't. You know, it's just part of the storytelling thing. And one of the things that Jim did in this movie, and one of the things he almost set out to do, is to make a statement that 3D is not a gimmick. 3D is not, like, something only for horror films and kids' animated pictures. That it's a storytelling tool that helps involve you in the world. And so the simplest thing that we did is the point of convergence in the 3D space was almost always, like 99.999% of the time, was what was the point of focus in the film photographically. So if, you know, if the focus point that the focus puller was pulling to was 12 meters, you know, away from the lens, the point of convergence, we used the toe-in convergence on our cameras versus the parallel method, was also 12 meters away from lens. On it, and as the focus puller dialed the focus, and we also had a stereographer who would be pulling convergence and interocular at the same time, would be identical, so that converged and focused on a character's face as they walk towards the camera, the convergence followed it, so that as you're looking at them, in other words, it operates exactly how the human eye operates.
Well, hang on a second. I'm with you there, except for going to jump it up a level in terms of technical. You just mentioned interocular as well, but if you were animating interocular, that's certainly not what my human head does, because the distance between my eyes doesn't change. Were you actually animating interocular as well as convergence?
Very, very, very rarely. 99.9% of the time, again. You know, I don't want to say with an absolute, I can't think of any shots off the top of my head where it was animated, but I don't want to absolutely rule it out, because then someone on the net will dig up one shot and go, you're an idiot. So most of the time they were not, but it was adjustable on the fly. And one of the things that we did have is the entire time we were filming live action is we had a booth off to the side you know, no more than 50 feet off stage. It was a booth the size of like a cargo container that had a projector, you know, 2K projector showing the stereo image live coming off the camera. And there's someone whose job it was to sit in there all day, every day with the glasses on and watch the stereo space live to make sure that everything was working out just fine. So, it, you know, stereo was not an afterthought. Stereo was never thought about as a gimmick. You know, we never had the guy paddling the bouncy ball into the camera or spitting into the camera. You know, there's a couple times where we did, you know, there's like a point in the end fight of the, oh, by the way, spoilers. There's the end fight, you know, and the amp suit punches a tree and there's all this debris that comes flying at the camera. And I was there, like, I was, you know, operating on my shot. I was like, Jim, if we just kind of come around just a little bit, that'll come right out on camera. He's like, that's a little gaggy, don't you think? I'm like, yeah, but it's organic as well. He's like, yeah, cool, okay, we'll do that. So there was like a couple times where it like happened organically, but we never set out to do that, oh, crap's coming at you, kind of 3D gag.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's no doubt that the film obviously embraced 3D from the outset. I guess what's phenomenally interesting is how much it was a pioneering or lighthouse beacon in the world of Toe-In, because quite frankly, most other major productions that I would rate as being hugely successful, films like Up, which were obviously 3D animated, are parallel. And it's almost as if Cameron is the leading advocate, not only of stereoscopic live-action work, but of the Toe-In, and that can produce issues with the fact that because it's no longer parallel, you have sort of a keystoning effect in the corners. Did you ever discuss keystoning as being a problem?
The idea behind it is that you're not worried about what's at edge of frame. If you are looking at what's at the edge of frame and seeing that, you're failing as a storyteller. That you're trying to guide the eye around the scene with focus and with stereo and with, you know, a character talking, not with, you know, we don't want people looking off into the corners. Is it sometimes a problem? Yes. But I don't think it was kind of set out as saying, like, you know, Jim's a big fan of parallel, too. It worked, you know. He's like, it works just as well. Ghost of the Abyss was a parallel film. So was Aliens of the Deep. That was done as parallel.
Oh, really? I thought that was... I always thought that was Toe-In. Okay.
No, those were... I mean, the Fusion camera, which is, you know, I'm sure as a gearhead, you could probably, you know, want to talk about the Fusion camera for hours and hours as well. But the Fusion camera is configurable, which is... The Pace Fusion camera is the, you know, stereo camera that was developed by... Jim and Vince Pace. It's the version we use on the film is based on the Sony F950, which is a 2/3-inch chip. People, so you know, a feature film can be made on a 2/3-inch chip.
Though I think you did pickup shots. Didn't you do pickup shots with the F23 and the F35?
The newer version of the Fusion camera is a. It's based on the F23 chip, I believe. It won't ever go to the F35 because the whole point of the Fusion camera is it is hand-operatable. You can toss it on your shoulder and you can run and gun. And you can't do that with a full-frame camera simply because of the weight of the glass.
And
it was,
the camera was broken in half in the sense that the thing that I think Cameron pioneered was getting Sony to split the record deck from the camera unit so that you could actually have a lighter weight.
Yes. Yeah, and it's still a pretty massive piece of gear. And, you know, loaded on the end of a techno crane, it looks like a beast from the deep. You know, it's with wires and everything going everywhere, but you can still toss it on your shoulder. And, you know, Jim did. You know, that's one thing I want people to understand is, other than the Steadicam shots in this film, Jim operated every single camera himself. There's a couple cameras that were done by Richie Banham, but every single camera, whether it was a practical or whether it was a digital, was operated by Jim himself. I mean, the guy knows his way around, well, everything on a set, but, you know, so...
Let me just hang on there. I'm going to come back and discuss the camera because I'm very interested to discuss the virtual camera technology, but I do want to get some other perspective on monitoring because... Mark, I was talking to John Noel at ILM, and he said that, interestingly, they ripped out all of the actual operator 3D monitoring, like at your desk, 21-inch, 17-inch monitors for the artist to review stuff on, because he thought that you couldn't judge anything but gross stereoscopic effects being wrong on a desktop monitor. And so with the exception of a couple of departments like the production department, just to check that there weren't gross errors, he required all the artists to review their stereoscopic work in the ILM Projection Digital Theatre. How did you guys work in terms of the stereoscopic workflow in post now? Because obviously David was on set. Were you monitoring your stereo stuff? How did it influence you?
We were a little bit more run and gun than that. And again, because we were in the design phase and not really having to focus so much on getting stuff to final, we were able to, you know, actually sit at a desk and review with the polarized lens glasses.
So were you using passive or active glasses at the desk?
Passive.
And,
so,
and that worked pretty well, right? I mean, I've seen it work, I thought, pretty well. Obviously, I'm not John Knoll.
Right. It does work pretty well, but I understand... I mean, I'm certainly not a detractor of John Knoll's point of view on this. And I will say my experience of the film itself, watching it in Real D, was less distracting in terms of a lot of some of the more unpleasant things that I've found with 3D in other films. There was really only one scene near the beginning when they're unloading all the troops that had significant strobing. For the all the action in this film, I really didn't have that unpleasant strobing effect that is often part of this, nor did I really experience it looking, you know, significantly dim or dull.
Well, that's the point I was going to ask Ian about, actually, because, Ian, you go and see a lot of visual effects films and obviously a fan of the genre. Stereoscopic, as Mark just mentioned, is going to reduce the amount of light level coming off the screen because it obviously has polarizing glasses. There's the fact that you've got to have... basically, the light path from the projector to your eye has got things in the way compared to a normal screen. Were you in any way conscious of this being a film that was dim or not as illuminated or not as bright as a normal film? Did you just feel normal to you?
Never. I always thought it worked perfectly, and that's something interesting that Mark said. I was never taken out of the film except for that, maybe that opening shot of the guys in weightlessness at the beginning, which was a little bit stroby, but no, it was always well lit and really easy to watch, actually, which isn't the same as some of the other 3D films I've seen recently.
So I'm assuming go on.
It's kind of almost an answer to the people who were complaining when they saw the trailer. They're like, everything's so bright and colorful. Perhaps, possibly, a genius filmmaker who was trying to revolutionize and mainstream 3D thought about the fact that you were going to be watching a movie with an ND filter in front of both eyes and maybe made it more bright and colorful, knowing that, so that by the time it bounced off of the screen and into your eyeballs, that the dimmed effect gave you the look of a regular movie. I'm just putting that out there as a possible thing, you know?
Hey, let's discuss the virtual cinematography, because it is really interesting. And as I say, for me, I moved past the stereo pretty early, and in that interview with John, we discussed stereo in great depth, and he has some really interesting points of view. But I want to discuss the virtual cinematography, because obviously, David, you were involved in it. So let's just... I'm going to give you my two-second précis of how I understood that it worked and see if I've got this right. Basically, in films ranging from Lord of the Rings, there's been an opportunity to get a feed from a digital environment to a camera that would allow the system to work both ways. It would, I think in Lord of the Rings, they started with... Peter Jackson grabbing the camera in one of the fight sequences with the orca and being able to just move the camera around and see the virtual environment at kind of almost wireframe level so that he could, you know, get more handheld movement. And there would be tracking markers that would identify where the camera was. And so obviously if you can work out where the real camera is that the guy is holding and that operator, that in this case the director, is also seeing the virtual world on the eyepiece or monitor of the, you know, pretend camera, then you can start to get some interesting stuff happening, because he whips the camera to the left to look at what's over there on the left on his little screen. The outside motion capture technology works out that the camera whipped to the left, and you get a much more organic, natural human camera move than you would if you just had a bunch of guys animating it. Now, Cameron took this to a whole nother level, and where you were talking about before, David, you were saying that there was motion capture data coming. So not only was there motion capture data coming off actors, presumably in suits, but that was being processed in real time enough so you could feed it back to, in this case, Jim Cameron operating, so he'd actually see in his little viewfinder or split a representation of a digital actor, which was pretty important because the digital actors were actually significantly different in scale than normal actors, but also it was significant because, David, if I'm right, you are simultaneously actually recording the live action of the live action actors.
Yeah, well, if I can, let me walk you through the whole process here, which it, I'll probably monopolize the conversation for a few minutes if no one minds. You can kind of break it up into four basic areas of the production. You had the pre-production phase, which is we would have environments, whether they were environments that were going to be the complete digital environments, like the forest, home tree, the willow glade, whatever it happens to be, that the art department, you know, we had this amazing virtual art department headed up by Rob Stromberg, Rob Powers, and Yuri Bartoli, who were putting together these incredibly elaborate environments, you know. But they also realized that they could pre-visualize the live-action sets that were not yet built, that they were going to be built down in Wellington. This is back in late 2006, early 2007. So we would build the environments that were going to be built completely live-action, and then we would scout them out, just like you would scout a live-action set. We had a troop of players, a number of actors who would play any number of roles. There were both, you know, traditional stand-ins and background players as well as stunt people. And so they would go out there and they'd play the character and we would work out the shots. And so for the live action sets, you know, we would walk through and Jim would say, okay, this wall needs to be a flyaway wall. You know, from here over can be all green screen and that'll just be a complete digital, you know, set replacement. And we worked out exactly what had to be built and what didn't have to be built physically. Therefore, you know, yes, it took more time at the beginning, but overall wound up being incredibly cheap. But often when we're scouting, just like when a director goes onto a live action set, you know, if you go to a location, you know, you may plan that the people are going to stand on this hill and look to the east, but when you get there, you realize that if you just try to turn the camera to the right 15 degrees, there's an amazing, you know, mountain that's in the view or whatever. So we'd look around the virtual sets the same way you would in live action and kind of block out and say, okay, this needs to be, you know, we need to redress this area or this isn't working, this really is working. And myself and the production designer that was in charge of the motion capture floor, Andrew Jones, there's two Andrew Jones that worked on the film. There's Andrew Jones, the production designer, and Andy Jones, who is the animation supervisor at Weta. I'm talking about the first one. We worked out this system where we would have physical items on stage. You know, we would have a gray painted cylinder that would represent a log, and we would have these kind of, the whole floor, we had the world's largest motion capture volume, standing motion capture volume, for quite a while. It was 72 by 36 feet, and it was broken up into 6x6 squares. And we would have these 6x6 plywood terrain pieces that were all labeled, you know, A, B, C, D, and they were just triangles that were broken in half at different angles. So they were basically plywood polygons. And therefore, that could be represented very easily in the digital world. So we'd have a terrain that would match a digital terrain that would match the physical terrain one for one. And we would go out there, and we had this thing, the most powerful thing on the entire film was this thing called the Zintegrator. It was this very, very precisely built stainless steel T-bar that was markered up as a prop, and Andrew would walk around the set. You know, we would do this whenever we would do a new set build, and we, you know, he'd walk up to a foam pillar and put the disintegrator up against it, and we would move a tree until it, you know, we would see where the disintegrator was in the digital set. It would move a digital tree to match, or he'd, you know, hold the digital, he would see the live feed out on the stage. He would see where the tree was in the digital world and move a foam piece to match. So we could build in the physical and match in the digital, or build in the digital and match in the physical. And therefore, we had a physical set that matched the digital set exactly. So you had the whole scouting and planning phase that was taken care of, you know, on the cheap, relatively. And then we had the performance capture, which was, you know, Jim would work out, like, okay, here's where the camera's kind of going to be from this angle, and the actors would just do what actors do best, which is act. And it was a very pure form of acting, where it was just, you know, Jim and the actors. And you know, on a set, people think that, like, an actor's life is easy because they don't do much on a set. You know, they'll sit in the trailer, and then they'll come out for, like, 20 minutes, and then they'll go back to the set. Problem is that you have all the other crafts that have to come in. You have makeup, you have camera, you have lighting, you have, you know, construction, all that kind of stuff. We didn't have to worry about that. All we had to worry about is the actors acting and giving a great performance and making sure that sound was record and facial and all the reference cameras were recording. But you didn't have to worry that, you know, the guy pushing the dolly was a half second too late, or that, you know, you didn't get a fantastic performance out of your star, and you're like, great, we can go home now, and then the DP going, oh, sorry, the focus was buzzed. We didn't have to worry about that, because that was all taken care of after. Then you have the live action set, which was down in New Zealand, and that was handled on our side by Dan Fowler and Casey Schatz. They were running what we called Simulcam, which is Glenn Derry, who kind of physically built everything we're talking about, the virtual camera and all that kind of stuff. He came up with the idea, Jim came up with the initial idea, and then Glenn realized it, that if we could track the virtual camera just like we could track a live camera. So Glenn eventually hooked up infrared LEDs so they didn't affect the lighting in the scene in any way, shape, or form. And we would track that. That would go into the giant system, which would then go into the motion builder system. The motion builder would send a CG signal out to a hardware keyer and back to the monitor, so you'd see, instead of seeing a green screen, you'd see the live-action actors, the live-action set, and then the digital set extension automatically right there in the frame.
I'm just going to interrupt you there for one second, because that was a really significant step, wasn't it? The fact that it went to infrared meant that you could suddenly start having studio lighting and light up a set properly and still have
accurate...
And that was a really pivotal point in the evolution of the process.
Absolutely. Like, that was the one thing with Jim is we're always being pushed to be on the cutting edge, but at the same time, we weren't allowed to make any compromises in terms of what he artistically wanted to do. The most hilarious thing that came into that is, you know, when you're trying to record motion capture on a live-action stage, you have motion capture cameras, of course. And you can spot them in the final film because Jim saw them, and rather than having to have them digitally painted out or whatever, he's like, they look like security cameras, because they are security cameras. He's like, leave them in. I don't care. They look fine. You know, they became set dressing all of a sudden. and then you had what we called camera, which was basically the performances were edited. The whole movie was edited in Avid by Steve Rifkin and John Rafua and Jim himself. And they would create a performance edit based solely on the HD reference footage that was recorded. We usually had anywhere from 8 to 10 F-950s recording reference on every single take of everything. So we produced a vast amount of data, vast amount of data on the film. But just on the production side, never mind the 1 petabyte of data that Weta wound up creating. But we... So they would edit the performance edit just like you would edit any other film. You know, it was just all about here's the way we're telling the story. That would then go to the artist in the virtual lab headed by Nolan Murtha, and we would create a scene file that had the best moments edited together in a narrative fashion. So, you know, if Sam's best take was take number 2 and Zoe's best take was take number 5, we would edit that together so that it cohesively made sense, and we would then do camera coverage on it. And it was great because whether you're doing a close-up or whether you're doing a wide shot or, you know,
so just to be clear about this, you're combining performance capture takes at this point, are you? Is that what you're saying? I'm sorry, just to be clear.
We are.
Okay, so not the live action, because you're talking about Sam, but obviously this is Sam acting as his avatar.
Yeah, Sam and his avatar set.
Right.
And we would then be able to do infinite coverage. And it was great because here's the great thing about performance capture is every single take, the actor is doing their best take, or at least the take that the director wants. And they're hitting their marks exactly. You know, and they're also, if you're on a live action set and you have Sigourney Weaver doing a close-up, 9 times out of 10, she's not performing with her co-star. She's performing to the lines being delivered by the second unit director or some PA who got pulled into it because her co-star is off in craft services getting a coffee or talking to their girlfriend or their boyfriend or whoever it is. Here, whenever you have a close-up of Sam, he's acting with Zoe or with Grace or whoever it happens to be. So you always have they're acting to other actors giving their all.
Now, the reason that you say that, just for people that aren't so committed, the reason you're saying that is because whereas you would normally sort of shoot the wide and then go in for the close-ups, and when you'd go in for the close-ups, you have to put the camera where effectively Zoe is, and so she would step away, yes, go off to craft services, and as any actress would, and then and Sam delivers his close-up line for a second time to the camera that's now intrusively very close to his face. What you're saying is,
right,
the two actors do the performance as normal because there are no need for any actual physical camera people to be anywhere near them. And when you've got that, if you want to now stick a camera exactly where Zoe was standing, of course, because it's just data, it doesn't matter.
Right. So, and in the camera phase, that's where, you know, we had this phrase, I think it was originally generated by Rob Legato, who had, like, kind of the initial ideas for this process. Rob Legato was the effects supervisor on the prototype back in 2005, and he, you know, called it director-centric, and that's really what it was. Because it was at this stage when we were doing all the coverage, I think a lot of people have commented on the cinematography that happens in the purely digital parts, and what we were able to do is at that point we can manipulate anything and everything about the scene. You know, I got an email from a friend of mine who, you know, completely didn't believe that the environments were all CG, and I was like, no, they were. And, you know, they were wondering, you know, well, was that like Massive? Like, yeah, Massive was, you know, they used a specialized version of Massive, but everything in the foreground was all hand placed. You know, if you see, like, a flying scene, every one of those clouds was meticulously hand-placed. You know,
once you've got that virtual environment, did, without any actors around now, obviously because you've done the capture of the performance and stuff, for the actual filming of the cinematography of that performance, which you can obviously now place a camera anywhere you want, was Jim Cameron picking up a physical device to feed that process, or was he sitting beside one of you guys?
What we had was what we called the virtual camera, which was a very basic, it was basically an LCD monitor with, it evolved over the course of the film. You know, we went through, I think, like three or four different iterations of it. It was an LCD monitor that had a hinge on it so that, you know, whether the camera was above, like even if it was above and tilted upwards, you could tilt the LCD so that you could always keep it in view. And we would just track that motion. And it had a handful of controls on it so that he could rock it around the set and that kind of stuff. So that motion capture data would go into the giant system, and that's just simple XYZ and rotational data. That would then go into the our system and through what was called the virtual camera constraint, which was at its core incredibly simple, but a beautiful piece of technology. It was programmed by this guy named Dan Neufeld, who, for someone who's 22 years old, is just way too smart for his own good. And it was, you know, incredibly solid, robust piece of software. And we could then manipulate the data. You know, so if Jim was moving the camera 1 foot on stage, we could suddenly make that 10 feet. You know, we could multiply it by 10 or 20 or by a half so that if you're doing a close-up, you know, rather than having the little kind of hand vibrations that would come in, we can null those out. And therefore, with just, you know, Jim's shoulders and this little item, we could replicate a techno crane, a dolly track, a helicopter, whatever it was. We could attach the camera, you know, digitally to an aircraft that's flying, or we could lay down a track so he would, like, you know, kind of chase the flying creatures through the scene, and then he would ride along that path as if it was a chase helicopter, and therefore it really gave a very strong, physically grounded feeling to every single shot. You never had these cameras that would fly, you know, all the way through the entire world and then, you know, at 100 miles an hour and come to a dead stop in a frame. You know, it all had this physical oomphness.
One question I had to, I wanted to ask was whether or not when you were operating the virtual camera, you could control focus or convergence, because I'm wondering whether it was just positional data or were you actually, was there any time?
No. Theoretically, we could, but we would, once we had a shot, and keep in mind, we would do dozens and dozens of takes of every single one of those cameras, you know, so that the camera, because the performance was going to stay the same every time, Jim being a person who likes to get things right, we would do the takes on the camera until it was right. So, you know, we didn't have to worry about an actress getting tired or, you know, someone having to, you know, their union rules saying they can only work 12 hours or whatever it is. We would just do take after take after take until it was right. People would be stunned by the hours that we worked on this movie.
Now, when that rig was at its finest, was Cameron seeing a stereoscopic view of the 3D world?
No,
or was he seeing a mono view?
No. So it was always a mono view, and it was always a mono view in editorial. What would happen is after we got all the camera coverage done, and after we manipulated all the scenes, like, we would spend a lot of time lighting, which I'll get to again in a moment. But once the edit was done, and we basically would pick the right camera movement for each story beat, that would go up to what we call wheels, which is where the camera would be tweaked. We would apply smoothing. I wrote a couple of smoothing algorithms on stage that would give it either a hand, like, we would take the very rough handheld feel, and we could either say make it handheld, which would just kind of take the edges off the move. We could make it a Steadicam move, where we would still have a handheld feel, but, you know, it made it feel like a Steadicam, or a kind of a crane or dolly move, where it would really take all the move, like, rough movements out of it. And we came up with the really clever names of level 1, level 2, and level 3 for that. But when it was up in wheels, they would tweak the camera movements, because sometimes Jim would be like, I would just want it, you know, give me a little extra, you know, head clearance at the end of the shot or what have you. And at that point, Chuck Kaminsky was the stereographer, and he would then go through and they would adjust both depth of field and stereo space at that point.
Can I I'm going to come back to you on that lighting and stuff in a second, but I just wanted to check on one thing. Mark, what were you guys receiving from Lightstorm in terms of what was the files that you were getting?
Well, we did get their stereo plates, and yeah, I mean, it really was not very dissimilar to any digitally shot.
But were you getting 1920 by 1080 SR tapes, or were they converted to DPX? And
yeah, by the time I saw them, they were DPX.
And now it was up to the vendors to do stereoscopic correction, right? So if you were finaling a shot, you actually had to, at the vendor level, solve, for example, why, you know, errors, and actually equalize the shots to be stereoscopically correct. Because you guys got a huge manual, right, from Lightstorm as to, like, process deliverables and everything else.
Well, right. Again, you know, since we weren't so much in the trenches, I think your John Knoll interview sounds like it's probably got the real dope on that. But, you know, we weren't held to quite the same standard, because what we were trying to do was really more design and aesthetic focused.
Right. So, in fact, much of your work would have been valid in a mono world for review and every other purpose, because a lot of the stuff is it wasn't specifically a stereoscopic effect. It would have been going into a stereoscopic world. Would that be fair to say?
Well, no, we were certainly paying attention to stereo. Let me put it this way. I think we were working to a level that on a normal 3D film would be pretty much par for the course. And my understanding is actually that most vendors who were actually focused on finaling a good number of shots really had to go a lot further than that.
Tell me, David, you were mentioning lighting. Why were you spending so much time in virtual lighting? Was that simply to give Jim Cameron a much better idea of what he was looking at?
Right. I mean, Jim is a lighting fanatic. One of the big hurdles that a lot of people, a lot of CG people, and I don't mean this as a detriment, they think like CG artists and they're trying to recreate the real world. And that is not what we were after at all. We're trying to create a cinematic world, right? People in real life don't walk around with strong rim lights and a 3-point lighting scheme around them.
And their
not how it works.
And their own dedicated eye light to ping their eyes.
Exactly. So, some of my friends thought I was nuts because, like, the first thing I did when I was going to move on to stage and I knew that lighting was going to be a big part of my job was I went and I watched every single Jim Cameron movie back to back to back. And then I went and took frame grabs from the movies and printed them out saying, like, this is emotional tenseness. This is a motherly scene. This is a somber scene. And I had this kind of three-ring binder of about 400 pages of just images that I would kind of go through every single week and just kind of like, this is how Jim lights. This is how Jim thinks about cinematic lighting, and would watch his camera movements. And you know, you'd have to put that kind of study into it. But you also have to be able to communicate in the language of film. You know, Jim is a very, very technical guy. He's one of the first directors I've ever seen that can sit down at a seat of Maya and start navigating around in the viewport. The problem is a lot of CG artists, they're like, okay, well, this is a spotlight, and I'm going to adjust the intensity up. That's not how DPs think. That's not how film people think. They think, I want a Kino 2K, and I want it 4 feet away, and then I want to double it down. And you need to be able to take that language that they just said and put it into the CG world and recreate it very, very quickly. Time is money. When you're doing CG on set, it is extremely, extremely, extremely high pressure.
I have actually heard Cameron saying that the key was not to somehow sample light and produce an HDR correct lighting model of a physically accurate light that you would see in a jungle, but rather that you would simulate the Hollywood reality of how a hero star would be lit in a jungle if it was, you know, under the rules of Hollywood lighting.
That's actually one of my biggest, like, problems with a lot of how, like, effects are done, is they'll go and they'll do a whole scene, and then they'll send the VFX supervisor out there to get, for 2 minutes, to go get an HDRI of, like, right before they strike the set. Well, that HDRI is fine, but that's not how the characters were lit in every single shot. Every single shot, the lighting solution is going to be different. And you know, CG artists need to stop thinking like nerds and start thinking like filmmakers. And that's really what it comes down to.
Let me ask Ian now for a second, because Ian, you and I have seen a bunch of films. I think for me, what I thought about Avatar in terms of its look and its lighting is that it didn't look filmic, it looked cinematic, but it actually had an aesthetic which is a new hybrid. It's partly video game, part, and I say that not in a negative sense, but just because it's not like a film grainy kind of look, and it's partly a bunch of different things. But this immersive stereo environment they had, I don't have a word for it yet, but I just feel like it's a new aesthetic. It's a cinematography rich environment, and it is very cinematic. It just doesn't feel filmic. When you were watching it, did you feel the same way, Ian?
Definitely. And I think part of that also comes from the world that Cameron created, because it's very colourful, and, you know, there probably isn't a world like that around there. And, you know,
I'm pretty sure there isn't, actually.
I mean, particularly at night with the neon colours, but even during the day, some of the creatures were brightly lit. And in some ways, I think that might be, you know, how he got away with creating this world, because it was just so colourful that you were transported away, you know, and you didn't try and compare it to the jungles of Africa, because it was actually quite different.
Yeah, I guess Ian's brought up a good point there, David. The that fluorescent colour stuff, many people have assumed that that's related to Cameron's vast amount of underwater work. Was there underwater reference Was that at any kind of stylistic level?
It was definitely... this film, visually, is the culmination, I think, of Jim's career to this point. You know, I think a lot of the Human Hardware is very influenced by the stuff you see in The Abyss or Aliens or Terminator, and a lot of the CG stuff is definitely influenced by the Deep Sea Dive. I mean, I think you can definitely look at... You can see a direct correlation between the aliens or undersea creatures in The Abyss to the real undersea creatures in Aliens of the Deep to the flora and fauna of Avatar. I think it's a direct line. I don't, you know, and yeah, there's definitely an influence, and it was brought up quite a bit. You know, Jim... The enormity of this project, I think, is a little bit lost on people. Like, they kind of comprehend it, but they don't really, where every little detail of this film had to be built. You know, every little bug you see flying around, even if it looks like it's 4 pixels, that bug was designed and thought about. And, you know, there's Latin names for every single plant and animal in this film, and the evolutionary kind of progress of how everything became... is thought about. So it's, you know, there's no, pardon my French, there's no bullshitting Jim, you know, so you couldn't just fake anything. So anytime you try to put something past him, which, you know, he never, you know, no one would ever try or even try once, never mind twice, but, you know, he would bust out the reference and say, no, look at this, and this is how it, this is what it's supposed to be, you know, you know, we would look up anytime there was you know, something flying. We would be looking at footage of helicopters or you know, explosions, or when, even though there's no actual you know, fire, like you know, gunfire in the film, we brought live weapons onto set and fired them off for reference. When you see, you know, James,
that would have been
Toad,
a fun day.
you know, when you see Jake out in the garden, you know, and he's crunching the soil beneath his toes, what we did is we went out and we got dirt, and it had to be a very specific dirt. You know, Jim worked on the mixture of dirt for quite a while until it was what he wanted to do, and then we filmed an actor standing in the dirt, you know, in order to you know, with like 10 HD cameras filming his feet to make sure that we, you know, it looked proper, like it looked filmic. We put people into water tanks to see how water would flow around them. All the actors, well, even though they're in the motion capture stage and you had, you know, we weren't motion capturing their hair, we put little, you know, dreadlocks on their head units, on their head rigs. And if they were on the flying rigs, you know, the Banshee or the Leonoptrix, we brought out a gigantic Ritter fan and hit it in the face with 60 miles an hour worth of wind from, like, 3 miles away. Not just because it enhanced their performance, because it definitely did, because it gave reference to the animators and to the people doing the cloth and hair sims on how the hair would be moving in that manner, you know? It was all about keeping this, for all the fantasy, for all the, you know, special effects of this, this is incredibly grounded in what happens and what happened in real life.
Well, now, Mark, can I jump over to you for a second and get you to put on a slightly different hat, rather than specifically talking about the design work and shots that you guys did, yeah. Because you have a slightly stronger degree of separation than David on this topic. I wanted to get your opinion on the human subsurface scattering type rendering of the digital characters from Weta, because obviously the film, we've discussed a bunch of visual cinematography, essential stereo stuff, but a huge aspect of this is believable performances from synthetic actors. And unlike Gollum, there's obviously a tight correlation between the actual facial animation of, Sigourney's avatar looked like Sigourney, but without just getting technical for a second, just from a viewer's point of view, you obviously just sat and watched the film at the cast screening. How did you feel the rendering worked on the Weta avatar characters?
Technically, I think you know, it was an advance to the highest level we've seen, more or less. I mean, the amount of close-up work, the first memorable screen kiss I've seen in CG. I'm sure there's been another CG screen kiss before, but this one felt like it was, you know, the proper kind of old Hollywood moment of a big screen kiss. So, you know, I think really successful in terms of technically, you know, taking it to the level they did. The funny thing about generally about the believability of the characters, the movie had to cross over the uncanny valley to work as a film. The world has to be a precious place whose loss is felt, you know, deeply emotionally by the audience, and the characters themselves also have to resonate that way. And it worked.
I mean, I actually think they could have titled this film Avatar: The Battle of Uncanny Valley, because you're right. If it didn't successfully get me to a place that I cared about these digital characters, then why would I care that they're digitally going to have their tree blown up and suffer? I had to be emotionally connected, and I've never felt as upset about a tree dying that I have in this film. But I thought that they really, and unlike a Pixar film, they weren't stylized. There was a sense of realism.
Now, having said that, what was missing were a lot of the imperfections that you get if they had been human characters on film, some of which I assume was a choice. They were a higher race in a perfect world in some ways.
You worry that they went to central casting of Pandora and got perfect actors. Is that what you're saying?
No, I think that these people are meant to, this race is meant to seem magnificent and
idealized.
Athletic, yeah. and very healthy and pert. Is that what you're trying to say?
That's right. But if you look at an idealized and very healthy and pert human, they're still going to have other things, you know, with their physicality that weren't part of this. And I don't take it so much as a fault as a choice. And it is, for me, where this whole film is at. It both, as you said, was in, you know, the world of a video game, and yet one that relied on us believing it and falling in love with its beauty and, you know, sitting and looking at it and being amazed by it for the better part of 3 hours.
I mean, I'll be critical in a minor sense, because obviously I love the film, but there was no point at which I was like the foliage, I was very uncertain as to whether I was looking at photograph stuff from Vietnam that had been camera map projected over, or completely synthetically generated foliage, or it was some live action stuff that they'd filmed and stereoscopically filmed. I mean, I just almost couldn't tell. I could completely tell that the Avatar characters were synthetic actors. I didn't at any second think, oh my God, is that prosthetic makeup? Because it was, in a sense, I didn't believe that the digital actors were at the same level of total, I can't tell where the actor stops and the character starts. That maybe I did in Benjamin Button. I'm not having a go at it being inferior, because I obviously bought into the film and I cared about it emotionally. But I wouldn't say that you could show me an actor in makeup and show me a digital character and there'd be no way I could pick it if you gave me a kind of, you know, which one is it technically.
I would agree some of the time, but there were more than a few close-ups where I was like, holy cow. You know, major spoiler, so lock your ears for 10 seconds or so, but the close-ups on the interior when Atu Khan gets killed and Atu Khan himself, I thought were unbelievably photographed.
No, I totally agree with you. That was excellent. But I've got to say, Sigourney's Avatar, there were times that I would look at that character and it wasn't, you know, I didn't feel like it was Sigourney in makeup. I felt that it was Sigourney's performance was being faithfully brought through. I didn't feel like it was comical or silly or anything like that. But I was not sitting there going, is that Sigourney in makeup? Is that digital? I can't tell. It's just too Whereas I totally felt that way with most of the foliage. I mean, there were some obviously incredibly had to be digital foliage, but there were tree shots and a bunch of other stuff that I was like, there, I mean, I give up. There's no point in me trying to guess what's going on here. I just cannot pick the diff. And I actually felt that way in Benjamin Button as well, and there were some shots of Brad Pitt. I was just like, no way can I tell yet whether we're on Brad Pitt or Brad Pitt in makeup or digital version of Brad Pitt's performance through. Now, of course, different film, different criteria and different scale because there's a lot less characters. But I don't think that the subsurface scattering, the characteristics of the skin, all that stuff is good. But by the same token, you are in one sense so far across the uncanny valley that it actually makes it a little difficult because you can't make them look like real people because they're a completely different race and yet they've got DNA from humans and yet I want them to believe they're real and yet I'm not going to believe they're real because I know they're not real because they're, you know, jumping off.
Head for Tom Blue.
Yeah, exactly. So where do you sit on this, Ian? Did you feel the characters were like... do you know what I'm saying about that sort of slightly, I knew it was synthetic, but I didn't care? Or are you all the way there?
Well, I think that's right. I think you buy into it. And one of the things that came out is that just the eyes, and I think I've read that they obviously spend so much time on the eyes like they did with, say, Gollum. And once you sort of start watching the film, you only watch the eyes, I think. And if they get that right, then I think everything else flows. And just on something with Sigourney's character, Mike, I think I also read that her avatar is meant to be 8 to 15 years younger than what she is in the film because it's been around for a little while. So I wonder whether that explains why it had a slightly different feel to it for you.
I love Sigourney Weaver as an actress. I think she's just magnificent. And I'm not picking on anything to do with the performance. It just literally, for me, the avatar felt... more like I guess because I could see Sigourney in the character and yet obviously it wasn't Sigourney. So, but I still at no point was like completely there. If you were to put me on a stand as a witness for the team, I was like, not going to be able to say, well, there's absolutely no way I could tell that wasn't makeup on Sigourney. It really didn't feel, but I felt it enough that I thought it was a magnificent film and deserves the Oscar and all that kind of stuff. Don't get me wrong, but it just, I don't know that, and maybe you're right, Mark, maybe it is just that it was an idealized less, because I would have actually liked to have seen more old characters and more diversity, I guess. There did seem to be a lot of the natives that seemed to be in a kind of middle zone of youthfulness, and there weren't a million kids and there weren't a million old people, but they certainly were there. But it didn't seem to have the same population distribution that I may have expected, especially when they were around the transference. I'm sorry, David, I don't know the name of the sequence, but the sequence where I'm trying to transfer Sigourney's body to her avatar spirit, as it were.
Grace's death scene.
Yeah, and a lot of the avatars a lot of the native Pandorian
Na'vi.
Yeah, the Na'vi were sort of a similar build, size, scale, etc. These are super minor points, but I'm just coming at it from a super critical standpoint. I have to, I guess, because all of the big ticket items were ticked. I wonder. Did you, because David, you didn't obviously do the final rendering, but at what point did you leave the film?
I left at the end of principal photography once in June of this year, 2009, when all the camera coverage, all the second unit, everything had been completed. And actually, after I left, they decided to do a couple of pickups, which I wasn't involved in. I basically, once the stage aspect of the film was done, I left the film. I stayed in kind of close contact with a few of the people, and including Jim himself, and was hearing tales about it. But they were finishing up all the turnovers to the vendors and that kind of stuff. So we had other people who were stage operators. We had Tyler Thompson and Dan Fowler and Ignacio Pena, but they also did a lot of time up in the lab, whereas I was on stage all day, every day for the entire production.
What was your principal software in front of you on your monitor at that desk? What was your principal tool?
Motion Builder.
Right.
Motion Builder. You know, we really kind of pushed it to the absolute limit, to the point where, you know, Autodesk, you know, very close partners with us on the film, would come by and see what we were doing and just be like, how are you doing this? You know, it's the program definitely has issues.
But it is a really good piece of software.
Nothing better for pushing hundreds of thousands of polygons and textures at the film or onto the screen. So, you know, and that was the amazing part, actually, about being on stage is, you know, we would open up a file and see the amazing work that all the artists upstairs had done and just be like, well, you know, damn. You know, it's like I said, we worked really, 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 really long hours on this film, and the thing that kind of kept us going a lot was knowing that we were working on something absolutely special and unique and new, and that just kind of kept us going.
I was going to have two questions for you, just in sort of finishing up, because there are two questions I've been dying to ask you ever since I knew you were on the film. Firstly, at what point did you get to see the whole script?
Day one.
So there was obviously tremendously successful security on this film. It didn't leak. The story didn't get out. There was no Wolverine publishing, but there was also no just general, this is what it's about.
I can tell you, actually, it's funny, when Wolverine got leaked, suddenly, like, before that, literally, you could have driven up to our building and tapped into our Wi-Fi and seen everything in there. But like the day after the Wolverine got leaked, you know, Fox security came down on you know, we lost all of our Wi-Fi. We weren't able to FTP anymore. You know, it was suddenly we were banned from having laptops. You know, our own private laptops. So it like, you know, security was never an issue because of that whole specialness that was kind of part of, you know, we all knew we were working on something special, and we, you know, it's almost sad for us now that the film is out because we had this little thing that only we had, and now we're kind of forced to share it with everybody.
Yeah, but it's so nice that the world can appreciate the amount of work that went on, and it's a part of cinema history now. It's, you know.
Yeah. But I
was the guy that operated Gone with the Wind or whatever it was. You know, I mean, that would be, it's, you know, it's the 2001 of our generation.
It definitely takes some pride in that. And there's a wonderful thank you ad from Jim and John Landau in the Cinefex that covers it. That meant a lot to a lot of people other than the nameless spellings. But Noah was really... Like there's security on any kind of film like this, you know, and there would be whole no cameras allowed on set big sign, and there would be you know, big sign on the door saying there's absolutely no visitors allowed on set without prior permission and that kind of stuff. But I was one of the people who was allowed to bring my camera on set because they knew that, like, people want to remember this. You know, some people probably want to really forget parts of it as well. But, you know, it's amazing now that the film is out and we're allowed to kind of share our pictures. There are just, everyone has all these pictures. There was never any real danger of anything of this film being leaked because no one wanted to ruin it for everyone else. You know, it was, everyone was taking enormous amount of pride in this film. So, I don't think there was ever any real danger of it being leaked.
Well, now, just in the final question, and this is probably the most important that I'm going to ask you in this entire session, did you get to keep your tabletop?
I did. I did. What he is referring to is my desk at work was it was built by construction. It wasn't like out of IKEA or Office Max or whatever.
It was a plank.
It was a plank of, it was literally a plank of wood. And every single person on the that went through the stage, you know, before they left the film, signed it. So, you know, it has Jim and Sigourney and Zoe and Sam, all the sound guys, all the true players, all the dancers that you don't see because their whole scene was cut out of the film, and all the PAs and all the artists and everyone like that, they all signed it, and that is in my storage unit in L.A., and that's, you know, I joked about it being my retirement fund that it's going to go up on eBay when I'm 60, but, you know, I'm never going to part with it. Unfortunately, someone drew penises on it at some point, that's just
Cameron can be just so, Cameron can be so childish at times, I tell you.
But that was actually, you know, one of the really cool things about the movie and my role on it, as well as, you know, other people who are on set, is, you know, as VFX artists, you usually don't have any kind of creative input on a movie. You know, you're given your plates, and you're asked to roto them or asked to composite in, a creature into it. And sometimes, like, if you're a senior modeler, you might get to have some input on it. The people who are on stage and up in the lab in the film had enormous creative input on the film.
Plus you had a heck of a lot more director face time than most artists.
When you're face to face with Jim Cameron for 16 hours a day, 6 days a week for 3 years, you definitely develop a rapport and can do things, but you're also entrusted with things like, the bonding that the creatures make, where the nerve endings kind of, mm-hmm. you know, are wriggling around and then they kind of grab hold of each other. I designed that, you know, just because.
Well, I like that, David. That was good.
Thank you.
Well done.
There's like a part of like the whole doing camera, you know, there's this moment where we had, you know, the Valkyrie shuttle is crashing and I saw these two boxes falling, you know, colliding together and a guy who was falling down right next to it. I was like, I'm just going to move him over a little bit and, you know, so he gets smashed between the boxes.
Oh, I noticed and that shot. When it tilts forward and then they were going to throw the bomb out. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yes. Yes, and it even has a Wilhelm scream on it.
Yeah, I like
you
that.
You know, and I was in the theater going, yes, my moment made it in.
Well, look.
You know, so it's like, that to me, like, I have that little, like, 2 seconds of, you know, cinematic history to myself. And, you know, Brad Alexander pretty much choreographed, like, half of that end battle himself. And, you know, it's, everyone on this movie could take enormous pride in their contribution to it. So,
and I must say that we've spoken obviously to you and to Mark, and I've enjoyed it immensely. But we want to do a complete we're not worthy to all of the artists at Weta ILM and the other facilities, frameworks, and everywhere else that worked on it, because obviously a massive contribution from so many artists. And as you said, there was so much detailing. Everything had to be designed. There was so much brilliant lighting, modeling, and animation work, as well as simulation work and people running through environments that, I mean, really, it was just impossible for me to take myself out of the film long enough to appreciate the work, except for I just walked out of the film actually quite intimidated by how good the visual effects were. I want to congratulate everyone. I do want to congratulate, obviously, Mark, you and David, but I'm sure you'll join me in saying a well done to all the artists that worked on the film, because it just was a monumental effort.
Yes, and it gladdened my heart to see all those names so prominently in those credits.
Yeah, it was nice, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't exactly a Pixar film, but at the moment when you actually saw the people who really gave blood, sweat, and tears to this in post, so prominent in the end credits, I found it a refreshing change.
Yeah. Ian, I'm sure you'll join me in saying, just as a film goer who paid our bucks and walked and sat down, we certainly got our money's worth.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the exciting thing about this film is that all the technologies seem to come together, the motion capture, the virtual camera, the stereo, and then there's obviously Weta's work, which, you know, they had a whole new lighting pipeline to do it in. So it's pretty exciting that it all came together to make such a good film.
We're going to be covering those issues to do with the individual houses as much as we can on FX Guide. We'll be doing stuff talking to those facilities and focusing on those. Obviously, we wanted to focus a bit today on the stuff that our own team, or as it were, our own members of the VFX show had done. But if you are a member of the, and I know a lot of people that are in the industry and worked on the film, listen to this podcast. Please check out our other ones where we try and focus on the stereoscopic work and the character feature work coming up on FX Guide. I want to just finish up by pointing out that David has moved from working on Avatar, which he was very generous in giving his time, even in the middle of all of that, to the VFX show, to a project in London where he's no longer going to be able to be a regular on the show for a while he's on this production. So we're not going to be able to, David, have you on for a little while, but we'll be hoping that you'll be listening, and certainly you have a standing invitation to come back the second that you're finished on or whatever it is you're working on over there at DNEG.
Yeah, most definitely will, you know, I won't be eager to come back necessarily because that means I've been fired. But you know, I will miss you guys, and I'm sure we'll talk.
You
know, and I'll still be on Twitter and all that kind of stuff. But for some reason, my employer might think I, thinks I might insult some possible clients when I compare their work to that of Hitler and an insult to filmmaking history. So I would have to either have no opinion whatsoever. And just say that everything is awesome all the time, or have to excuse myself from the show for a little bit. So I chose to, I owe it to my listeners and fans, because I do have to thank them. They've been incredibly, incredibly generous and nice. I got to see Avatar, you know, I didn't get to go to the cast and crew screening in L.A. I got to see Avatar here in London because a listener who, which is his name, remain anonymous, gave me his IMAX ticket for opening night. You know, his midnight screening ticket that he had won, and he's like, you should see the film before I do. And, you know, that kind of amazingness is touches my heart. So I will miss all of you guys. So.
Well, we should point out, we actually think DNEG is a terrific company, and we totally love the fact that you're working there. They do magnificent work, and we understand their policy, and we're not trying to fight it in any way, shape, or form, just other than to say that the second that you do get fired for being such a lazy bastard, then you're welcome back on the show.
Thanks.
Now, just before you go, just give us your Twitter, because it's a good way to follow you on Twitter.
Yeah, twitter.com/DavidStrapinis. You can also go to davidstrapinis.squarespace.com, and I'm still allowed to have an opinion there for some reason. And I often will. So you can look me up there. If you're in London or in Europe at a whole, you know, I'd love to meet up with people or whatever, because I plan on seeing as much of the continent as I can.
I'll come back to you in a second, because I'll let you give Todd our shout out for today's terrific show notes. Though of all the people, you needed them the least. Mark, where are you at the moment, and where can people follow you?
My Twitter is Flowseeker, FLOWSEEKER. That is just a fine place to go find me.
What are you currently working on?
I'm working on getting out of here and going on Christmas vacation, actually. So there won't be much on that Twitter account for a little while.
And Ian, obviously you're a contributor to FX Guide and a very valuable one at that, but you're also on Twitter?
Yeah, it's just twitter.com/VFX blog.
And thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. And David, do you want to just give a shout out to Todd, who's done a magnificent job in putting together our show notes and stuff?
Yeah, the amazing Todd Schultz, and of course, Mike, you have been the rock of the VFX show, and I thank you very, very much for letting me be a part of it.
Well, thank you, my friend. Much. And thanks for getting me on set. I really appreciated it. It was great fun.
Oh, yeah. And I think you also liked the script as well.
I have a signed script from Mr. Cameron himself. It's very, very kind of you, sir.
Of Aliens, not of Avatar, before, you know, Fox Legal comes after me.
No, but it was a second draft script, so it's a cherished item that sits right by my desk. Hey, thank you guys so much for listening to us this year. It's the last VFX show for the decade. We want to thank everybody involved. This is a combined effort from Pixel Core and FX Guide, and we just really want to thank you guys for listening. There's actually astonishing loyalty. I'm not astonishing, but I mean, I'm just enthusiastic as to how many people listen to the show each week, and we try and bring it to you as regularly as we can, but of course, given that we're all working in the industry, we have natural production problems, but you guys have stuck with the show year in, year out, and we've really appreciated it. It's a It's tremendous industry that we work in. We just love doing it. And we, as I've said a few times, your feedback and the comments you send us are the oxygen upon which we do the show by. So thank you so much for listening to us. We'll come back and have more amazing stuff for you in 2010. Until then, check us out either at FX Guide or at thevfxshow.com. Thanks so much. Bye.